as yet. She's been working with open source software for some 20 years and has contributed to the GIMP, Mozilla, and an assortment of other projects. She's a long-term member of the GIMP community and enjoys giving GIMP courses and presentations, as well as filling up a hard drive with digital images, which is something that I tend to do too. She lives in San Jose, California, with her husband and a motley assortment of old computers. She is, of course, the one and only Akana Peck.
Thank you. Forgot to turn the microphone on. So how many of you use GIMP already? Pretty much everybody. How many of you are basically beginners? Everybody. Okay, well that's good. I'll start from the beginning. I'm going to go through photo manipulation probably fairly quickly, but feel free to stop me at any time, ask questions, tell me if I'm going too fast. I want this to be interactive. And of course, feel free to follow along on your laptops. You know, I won't have any specific assignments for you. But if you have any questions or can't find anything, let me know. The tutorial is intended for beginner to intermediate. So after I talk about photo manipulation, which many of you already know probably, I will be going on to more advanced concepts. My real goal is to get everybody really comfortable with using layers, because that's the heart of GIMP, and that's where most people get stuck. I know I did. If you want to move on from photo editing, if you want to take your photos and make them into postcards or make art for your website or something, that's basically the intended audience. I will be using GIMP 2.2 for this presentation. My book, which came out a while ago, supposedly covers GIMP 2.4. That's because when I wrote it, GIMP 2.4 was supposed to be out way, way before the book came out. If you're following GIMP development, you know GIMP 2.4 still isn't out. So 2.3 is the current development version, and it's really good. And if you don't mind building your own software, I do encourage you to download it, because there are tons of new things and tons of user interface improvements. A lot of things are really a lot easier to use. But since I know most of you don't have GIMP 2.3 already, I'll be using 2.2 for the talk. And you don't want to watch slides, you want to watch GIMP, so let's get started. A few years ago, I went to the Grand Canyon in Arizona. I'm from the U.S. And, of course, when you go to the Grand Canyon, you have to take lots and lots of pictures. Everybody does. My husband always makes fun of my tendency to take pictures of dead trees. I find them very picturesque. He finds that funny. But here's my dead tree picture. And, of course, dead trees are vertical, so the first thing you have to do is rotate it. GIMP has two ways of rotating images. You can rotate by increments of 90 degrees, which doesn't lose any image quality, using the Image Transform menu. So I'm going to rotate that. Now that looks like a normal photo, except if you look closely, you may or may not notice, but I was in a photography club years ago, and they always dinged me for not having level horizons. Photographers are very, very picky about level horizons, and if you ever enter a photo competition, you'll never get away with a picture like this. You know, it's just horrible, horrible, horrible. So for that, I need the free rotation tool. Now, this, you probably all know, this is called the toolbox, this GIMP window. And each of these buttons is a tool. It has a little tiny icon that you can't possibly interpret, so you have to hover over each one and figure out what the tooltip is. Also, they move around sometimes, so you just have to get familiar with where the tools are in your particular version of GIMP. These four tools are called transform tools. You can rotate, scale, shear, and change perspective. And they're really useful, but rotate is probably the most useful, especially for photographs. So I click to select. For all these tools, click on the tool in the toolbox and then click in the image to start it. For the transform tools, this is one of the places where GIMP 2.4 has gotten a lot better. These annoying dialogues that always pop up right over your image so you can't see what you're doing, they're gone. Is that a question? No. Okay. click in the image, and I can rotate it. But even then, that's kind of hard. It's hard to tell when the horizon is exactly level. And I used to do, you can see the angle here. You can use the measure tool to figure out, I need exactly 2.93 or something. That's horrible. Don't do that. Instead, down here below the toolbox, it can be docked as a separate dialog, but normally it's right here below the toolbox, is something called tool options. And nearly every tool has a bunch of useful options. It's always good to look at what the options are and see if you're missing something. In this case, the rotate tool has backward, and I can change the preview mode to grid. And then if I click in the image, all I have to do is line everything up. If I get the lines lined up with the horizon, I should mention this laptop is a P3700, so it's not GIMP's fault that it's slow. There, another horizon is level. Yes? Right. Right, so I dragged in the image to rotate it. No. No, free rotates are not lossless because it has to do interpolation between the pixels. Generally, there won't be a lot of loss in the middle, but on the outside, you probably will lose quality if you look closely. And for that reason, when you rotate, if you're going to rotate a photograph, you should probably rotate the full resolution photograph before you scale it down in order to reduce the quality loss. Now, when I rotate, you probably notice these checkerboards on the edges. If you rotate a rectangle just a little bit, you don't have a rectangle anymore. So GIMP fills in the edges with transparency. That means there's nothing there in this part of the image, and the way GIMP indicates transparency is a checkerboard. You can change that in the preferences. You can make the checkers different colors or bigger or smaller, and the only reason you might want to do that is in case you're working on an image of a gray and dark gray checkerboard, which occasionally happens. There's a neat optical illusion image floating around that where a checkerboard changes color from one side to the other. But anyway, I don't want transparency in my final image. I'm probably going to save this for the web, put it on my website. So I'm going to use the crop tool, which looks kind of like a scalpel or a knife. Crop tool you've probably all used. It's one of the most useful tools for photo manipulation. Select it. Click in the image. The annoying dialog comes. Wherever the dialog was before, the crop tool figures out where you've moved the window and always comes up over the image. And in 2.4, the crop tool is much nicer. You don't have, it's a lot less confusing and it doesn't have the dialog. So you can adjust these, you can move it around with these two corners. And when you're done, don't worry about the dialog. Put it somewhere else. Just click in the middle of the image. Oh. I double-clicked there. That's why I did that. But anyway, it did my crop. Yes? Mm-hmm. Yes. The question was if you rotate once and then rotate again, is there going to be twice as much loss? And the answer is yes. Every time you do an operation like this, there's a little bit more loss. So if you do a rotation and you don't like it, undo. Undo is your friend. It's in the edit menu like in most programs, but it's also on Control Z. And if you're like me, you'll use it probably 8 times as much as any other GIMP operation. So just remember the key binding, Control Z. Use it all the time. There it is. Redo. It's sometimes Control Y and sometimes Control R, depending on the version. But so you don't need to remember that one, but Control Z is good to remember. Okay, well now I have an image I can save for the web. Cool. So let's save it. I could just Control S to save on top of itself, but let's pretend that I'm editing the original image. I don't want to change that. So I'm going to save as. It has lots and lots of file types that you can save to. So let's talk about file types a little bit. I think that's next. I'm editing a JPEG, which is the format that comes from my camera, comes from most cameras, except the really high-end ones. JPEG is great for photographs. Do people generally know about the difference between image formats? Some do, some don't. So apologies for those of you for whom this is review. JPEG is full color. So photographs are great. It's also very efficient at compressing full color images. So you can have a photograph with all kinds of colors, and it'll be very small on disk if you compress it a lot. And it can still look pretty good that way. The disadvantage of JPEG, is that the compression is lossy. That means every time you read it from disk, make a change and write it out, even if you don't make a change. If you read it from disk and write it out, you lose a little bit of quality, just like with the rotate tool. So that's fine once or twice. You really won't notice the difference reading in a JPEG and writing it out once or twice. But if you're going to do a lot of edits to an image, don't use JPEG. It'll degrade more and more every time you edit it. There are ways, for simple transformations like 90-degree rotations, there are actually ways of doing it in a non-lossy way. There are programs like JPEG-TRAM that'll do that, but GIMP won't. Reading in a JPEG to GIMP and writing it out again will always degrade the image a little bit. GIF is the other really common format. It's, I believe, no longer patent encumbered, so it's okay to use it. But it's not good for photographs. GIF can only display 256 colors. It's indexed, so it has a table of up to 256 colors that it can display in any one image. And that means it's good for web icons. If you have a little bug that you want to put on your website or something, GIF is great. It can be very, very small. It can have transparency. It can do animation. It can do lots of cool stuff, but don't use it for photos. You won't like the result. Ping is a funny image format because it can kind of do both. It can do full color photographs, but they'll be very, very big, much larger than JPEGs. So you probably don't want to use it for the web, but it's a really good format to use, for instance, for scans. Anything where you've got an image, you don't care how much space it takes up on disk, and you want to be able to edit it over and over again and not lose anything. Ping is great for that. It also has another mode, indexed ping, which is a GIF substitute. And I'm not sure if it was written to replace GIF, but it is a good GIF replacement. You can use it for web icons, but be cautious because Internet Explorer doesn't support ping very well. Mozilla does, so if all you care about is free software people, you can use ping as a complete GIF replacement. It does full transparency, anything from slightly transparent to translucent to... No, ping doesn't do animation. There's a format called MNG that is sort of animated ping, but it adds a lot more, and it's not supported by any browser right now, including Mozilla. There are various patches to do animated ping in Mozilla, but they aren't widely adopted. So MNG really, if you want animation, you pretty much have to use GIF, and that means if you want to animate a full-color image, you have to accept that you can't have all your colors. It's going to be indexed, and it's going to only have 256 colors. Finally, XCF, the GIMP's native format. For most of the operations I'll be talking about during this tutorial, you want to be saving in XCF. Anything with layers, anything where you want to save a selection, XCF can save all that, and no other format can. XCF is lossless. Yes. In fact, all of these are lossless except for JPEG. JPEG is the only lossy image format in common use. So you can write and rewrite GIFs, pings, anything like that. Well, conversion to GIF is lossy because it only has 256 colors. Right. Right. Once you have a GIF, you can read it in and write it out, and you won't lose any more data. Other image formats you may hear about, TIFF is kind of like ping in the sense that It's non-lossy. It saves full color. It can even do things like 16-bit color. And so publishers sometimes like it. Some scanner programs use it. But the problem with TIFF is that it isn't a real standard. It's a collection of standards. And often when you read in TIFF to the GIMP, it will say, it'll complain about something or other. It'll say TIFF doesn't follow the standard or something like that. And then it'll usually read it in anyway, so it's usually okay. But I don't use TIFF much myself because of that. Yes, TIFF files are gigantic. TIFF does have several different ways of compressing it. If you save a TIFF file from the GIMP, it'll ask you what sort of compression you want to use, and you can tune the size a little bit like that. BMP, mostly you will see BMP from clueless Windows users who send you enormous files in email. We've probably all gotten that. AOL users love to send BMPs. For Linux users, don't use it. There's no reason to use it. Yes, I saw one of those recently. Yeah, I saw somebody who scanned an image from a newspaper as a BMP, loaded it in a Word document, and sent it out to a mailing list. It was quite impressive. So don't do that. GIF is actually a really good format for scans because you can tune the size of a GIF by specifying the number of colors. If you convert to indexed, let me just show you where that is. Image, mode. Every image has a mode. Up at the top, see where it says RGB? That's pretty small. Yeah, you probably can't read that. But at the top of the image, it will always say the mode. It'll say RGB, indexed, or grayscale. And you can change that in the menu, RGB, grayscale, and index. If I were to change this image to indexed mode, I can generate an optimal palette and set the number of colors. So if I set this to, I could use a black and white palette, which is good for scanned images. Or I can, if I am using a web icon or something and I know I've only used 8 colors, then I can make it 8 colors. I can make the file much smaller. But I probably wouldn't want to do that for a photograph like this. I'll show you what happens. That's what happens. So that's the danger of using index formats for photographs. Of course, with 256 colors, it wouldn't look quite so bad, but undo. Okay. ICO is another Windows format, but this one's actually useful because it's used for save icons. So that little this is a local file on disk, so it doesn't have a save icon, but the little thing right here at the left side of the URL bar and the thing that shows up in your bookmarks menu down here, those are save icons. They're in ICO format, and if you save in ICO format from the GIMP, you can make your own save icon, name it saveicon.ico, and put it on your website, and then people will see that when they visit your website. Yes? I always forget. I think 32 by 32 works pretty well. And you can use full color. When you save as an ICO file, it asks you several questions about number of colors, and I was always very confused by that. But full color does work. Yes. Right. He was pointing out that you can save as ping. You can make a save icon that's a ping and use it in Mozilla. I don't think that works in Internet Explorer, though. So if you want a save icon that only shows up to cool people, use ping. And a lot of people do that, actually. A lot of free software sites have a ping save icon and ping. I mentioned that Internet Explorer doesn't do ping properly. It will show pings, but it doesn't show the transparency in pings. So if you have, say, an image of Tux, if you have tux.ping on your website or something, then people using Mozilla, Firefox, any free software browser will see a nice, cool image with a transparent background, and Internet Explorer people will see an ugly background, they'll get an uglier site. And that's kind of cool, too. So some people like to do that. Now, PostScript and PDF, I only include because people ask about them. They're not formats that you want to use for the GIMP because they're vector formats. Yeah, XPM, there are actually a lot of other image formats. I'll go back to this slide. Yes. That's true. XPM format can be useful for sending through email. They tend to be huge, so you generally won't want to use XPM for anything that's not very small. It's sometimes used also in code. XPM can be included in a C file, and so sometimes programmers use XPM, but I haven't found it to be very useful lately. I think it's sort of going out of favor, and most of the time, if you need XPM, you'll know it. So you probably won't want to use XPM just in general to save your image. There's some, let me show you the Save As dialog again. GIMP has some other cool things like ASCII art. You need libAA for this, and not all GIMPs come with it. But if you build your own, make sure you have libAA dev installed, or AALib, or depending on your distro. AA stands for ASCII art, and it can save either as a text file or as an HTML file, and it can even put in colored text. So it's pretty cool. I always make sure to build my GIMPs with ASCII art, and I use it about once a year, but I like knowing I have it. Okay, PostScript and PDF. Vector formats are more a mathematical concept than a raster concept. So I want to talk about raster versus vector because that's pretty critical to image editing in GIMP. Images are made of pixels. And that seems obvious, but it's easy to forget it, and a lot of people do forget it. An image has a certain number of pixels across and a certain number of pixels down. And no matter what size you tell it is, you can tell it it's 8 inches by 11 inches or whatever, it still only has that many pixels. A vector image is different. A vector image is a mathematical concept. It says something like, there's a circle of size 5 here starting at this location, and then there's a line from here to here and another line from here to here and a square over here. And so it's almost like a programming language. In fact, if you look at a PostScript file, it is a programming language. And you can express photographs in a vector format like PostScript. You can express lines and squares in raster. But generally, you don't want to move between the two. So GIMP can import PostScript and PDF, but you don't want to save back to those formats. Yes, I should have put that in the slide. Raw images are, GIMP can deal with raw images. It uses an external plugin. There are actually a couple of plugins that can deal with raw images. One is called UF Raw, and if you Google for UF Raw, you'll find the plugin. And people seem to like it a lot. I don't have a camera myself that can generate raw images, but generally, what you do is take the raw image and manipulate it and turn it into some other format, and then GIMP imports it from there. Okay, images are made out of pixels. And if you want to refer to your image as 4 inches by 6 inches or anything like that, a physical measurement, you have to include the concept of dots per inch, pixels per inch, really. So PPI and DPI are pretty much the same when you're talking about raster editing. They mean a different thing when you're talking about a printer. And size is really only useful for printing. So people show up on the GIMP channel all the time saying, I have an image and I said that it was 8 by 10, but when I print it as 8 by 10, it's all blotchy. And it turns out that it's like 200 by 300 or something. The number of pixels in the image is what controls the quality of it. And print size GIMP has a separate image print size. I can set the print size for this image to anything I want. I can say that it's going to be a banner 6 feet wide, and it won't change the amount of resolution that the image actually has. It won't improve the pixel resolution. So don't get confused, and I recommend always using pixels as your unit. You can, I can change to millimeters here, and the rulers along the side of GIMP will show me millimeters, but they're lying to me. GIMP can smooth the pixels if it's printed very large, and so can printers. Printers also have software to do that, but there's only so much you can do there. When you're scaling something up, if you take a small image made of pixels and scale it up, it's either going to be fuzzy or it's going to be blotchy, or both, probably. So you really don't want to scale up large images any more than you need to. You can sometimes, you can sharpen and you can run some tricks, but you're never going to get all that quality back. So speaking of pixel size, this is a fairly large image. It was 2 megapixels when I started. You remember I cropped it a little bit after I rotated, so it's slightly less than 2 megapixels. If I put that on the web, users are going to be very angry at me, especially if I have any friends still using modems. And there are a few of them out there. So for the web, you always want to scale images down. That's in scale image. This box right here ties these two fields together. So if I scale, if I want to scale this down to say 500, make it bigger than that, make it 700. I hit tab there. I should have, let me reset. Okay. If I change this field, the other field will change too as soon as I click somewhere else or hit a tab. And I sort of hit tab reflexively after I type in one of these fields. Whoops. Well, I'm just going to hit tab. That's the easiest way. Now, if I don't want that to happen, if I only want to scale in one dimension, I can click this first. This is a chain link icon. It links the two fields together. If I unclick it, then I can change. I can change one and not the other, and then I'll get a very strange-looking image. Short, fat tree. Undo. Right, I was doing scale. Sorry. I'm going to go ahead and scale it. I think they've fixed that in 2.4. In the preferences dialog, if you haven't gone through your preferences dialog, I highly recommend it. There are lots of cool stuff, lots of cool things there. I think that's in, if I have to find it. Yeah, there we go. Okay, default interpolation for scaling. None means if I scale an image down, it looks at a pixel and it maps a big pixel to a small pixel, basically. It's not going to do any interpolation between the pixels. Linear means that it does, how do I explain that? It's basically just how much math it does to figure out what to put between one pixel and another. These don't matter so much when you're scaling down, but if you're scaling up, it matters a lot. If you have a ramp of color from one pixel to another, you can end up having an image that looks kind of blotchy if you use none or linear. If you use none, you'll end up with great big squares of pixels. Usually whatever GIMP says is best is the thing to use, and it should default to that, and future versions will. The GIMP 2.4 adds another one called Lanxos, which may or may not be better than cubic, and people argue about which is better. But as long as you move from something better than linear, you'll probably get decent scaling. But as I said, this is only really useful when you're scaling up, and most of the time you shouldn't scale up, because even regardless of the interpolation you use, you are going to lose quality doing that. Now, when I scaled down, I got a tiny image. That's way too small to put on the web. And the reason is that GIMP is only showing me the image at 33%, because that's the scaling factor it was using before. I want to zoom back to 100 now. Well, that won't fit on the screen. So what I'm going to do is use the minus key, which zooms out. You can see that in the view menu. View, zoom. Zoom out is minus, zoom in is plus. And another little trick you can do with this is that GIMP lets you change the key bindings. Plus is the shifted key on my keyboard, and I always forget to hit shift. I want it on one key. So I'm going to, if you move the mouse over the thing you want to change and type the key you want to have assigned to it, notice the plus changed to an equals? Yeah. It's a great feature. It used to be that all GTK apps supported this, and then they made it harder. And fortunately, GIMP still supports it, but, yes, permanently, but you need to know in preferences, I think that is in interface. Save keyboard shortcuts on exit. It is not on by default. Turn it on immediately. At least if you're like me and you like to use the keyboard for things, you will want to assign shortcuts to tools you use often. There's actually... Yeah, configure keyboard shortcuts. And it's not the best interface, but you can search through it. You can also look in... Yeah, there's a reset button. I can't type. Right, that's why I showed it. Right, it's off by default. Configure keyboard shortcut. I guess they think that it'll confuse users because you could accidentally type something when you're showing a menu, but everybody should turn it on. It's a wonderful feature. I believe it's set in menu RC here, although I don't... Anyway, it's in some file here in your .gimp, so if you get tired of looking through the user interface, you can have a quick way of changing it or viewing it. Oh, one other thing I wanted to show about JPEG. If I save as JPEG, it asks me a bunch of annoying things. Your image should be exported because JPEG can't handle transparency. Well, there's nothing you can do about it. It's not going to modify the image as you're editing it in GIMP. So just go ahead and say export for any question like this. Now, I cropped away all the transparency, but GIMP still thinks that there's transparency on the layer. So it's going to ask me forever unless I do something to get rid of it. But the cool thing here is the quality slider. Now, I mentioned that JPEG had... It has a lossy compression, and you can get very highly compressed images. Now, right now, if I save this image, it's going to be 72 kilobytes, and it's saving at 85% quality. That's just a number. It doesn't mean anything. You might think if you go to 100% quality, surely it won't be lossy, and that'll be best. 100% for some reason is not something that you're supposed to use in JPEG. It makes the image huge. 261 kilobytes now, and supposedly it's not any better than about 95%. So don't go to 100. But the interesting thing is that you can go way down in quality, and the image still looks okay. This is the preview, And it still looks pretty good, really, at 35%. And I've gotten the image size way, way down. Now, one thing is I'm zoomed at 66%, so I'm going... Another useful key, if you hit the one key, the number one, when focus is in the window, it always shows you full size. So if you want to see what your pixels actually look like, just hit the one key and you can quickly get there. I believe the one in the window is size in memory.
But it's still smaller than the original. That's the RGB size in memory, whereas the size, say, the JPEG is the size it's going to be when you say the JPEG.
Right. This is the size that it's going to be when I say this JPEG, not the size it's taking up in memory. And that's why it changes when I move the quality slider. Now, if I move it way down, you can see that suddenly it's starting to get pixelated, it's starting to get really bad. So you can tune the quality quite a bit. I mean, it's also tiny. The image is getting very, very small here. So you can pick your quality level, but for web images, often you can have really low quality and a really small file size, and people will never know the difference when they're just looking at stuff in a web browser. I'm going to save it a little higher this time. And then I'm going to hit the minus key. Whoa! Oh. So that was the JPEG preview. I just hit the minus key on. Right. Okay, the question is, in the scale dialog, you have this width and height, which I set, the pixel size, but you also have X resolution and Y resolution. You have these DPI fields. What's up with that? What's up with that is that I recommend never using these fields in the scale dialog because they're very, very confusing to everyone. And, in fact, I think they're gone in 2.4. They really are very confusing. The resolution, every image has a resolution built into it. Most image formats have a way of saying, you know, whatever pixel size this image is, it's also 72 dots per inch, or it's 300 dots per inch, or whatever. And the only time that's ever used is if you print. So if you print, it'll take the dots per inch, and it'll try and multiply by the actual pixel size, and then it'll try to print at that size. If you hand it to a professional printer, they will probably look at the dots per inch on the image and try to print at that size, even if you tell them otherwise, even if you tell them what size to print. So if you're printing stuff, you do need to know about this DPI, and you need to calculate it out. But in the scale dialog, you really don't want to use it in the scale dialog. If you ever do want to change the DPI of your image, I recommend using print size, just because it's much easier to, it's conceptually easier. You know, here you can set inches, millimeters, whatever. You can set the resolution. So if you're going to deal with resolution, if you're going to deal with dots per inch, do it from the print size dialog and just pretend that it isn't there in the scale dialog. Yes, wouldn't it be easier if you're printing it yourself to just use the printer dialog and not deal with this? And absolutely. I don't actually ever set it resolution and don't even look at resolution on my images. Right. I use GIMP Print for almost all of my printing, the GIMP Print plugin, which is now called Gutenprint. And it has an interactive scale. You can drag a slider to change how big it is. You can drag it around on the page and see a preview. And I like doing that, but every now and then I actually need resolution. For example, if I have a scan, and sometimes I use my scanner as a photocopier, and then I want to print it exactly the right size that came in from the scanner, and there's a checkbox in the GIMP print dialog for actual size or something like that, and that's the time when it would use resolution. Not really. Monitors are all over the board as far as resolution. I think this laptop is 100, and of course, this display is much, much less because it's the same resolution as my or the same pixel size as my monitor, but with much bigger pixels. Yes, dots per inch is different. So my monitor, for instance, is 1024 by 768, and it's, I forget how big it is. It's officially a 10-inch monitor, but it's, so. Right. Okay. So where am I? Oh. Now, moving on, there's another problem with this image, in addition to having been rotated improperly. The Grand Canyon was really hazy when I was there, and you notice there's almost no detail in the canyon. You can see kind of red stuff, but you can't tell it's the Grand Canyon. And in the colors menu, there are colors menus all over the place, and in 2.4 they're all consolidated to one top level menu, but you can find a colors menu under layers color. You can find it under tools, color tools. There are some color things under filters, colors, all kinds of color things. So I usually go for the ones under layers. Brightness contrast, you've probably all played with images. You can do amazing things, bump the contrast, bring out canyon details. Now you can actually see it's the Grand Canyon and the tree looks awful. No, it's way too contrasty and the sky doesn't look any good. Wouldn't it be nice if there was a way to bump the contrast only on the parts that need it? Oh yeah, there is. Selection, very important. Now in this image, if you've done a fair amount of GIMPing, you're saying, oh, she's cheating because she's using an image where the horizon is nice and flat and it's difficult in 2.2. You can, but it's not that easy. You can add to the selection with these buttons here. Add to the current selection. So if I if I add that, it gets bigger. I'm going to undo that and show you. Zooming in is always good in a case like that. So if I add to the current selection starting there, the problem is I didn't rotate it exactly. So if I do that, I'm going to select some of the sky. But these buttons are pretty useful, and they are bound to keys. You know, control, let's see. If you can see that the cursor added a little plus next to the, oh, it's gone now. Yeah. Oh, it has a plus because of that. Well, no, it didn't. I don't remember the key bindings for add and subtract because I just used the buttons. Okay, add to the current selection, subtract from the current selection, intersect with the current selection, which is only there because GIMP is free software written by programmers. I haven't ever encountered a situation where a normal user would want to use this. But anyway, in GIMP 2.4, you can actually click on the selection and resize it just like with the crop tool. You can drag the rectangle around. The ellipse selection does that too. It's wonderful. I mean, that's the number one reason to use 2.4. Okay, so now, oh, another GIMP trick. I get tired of navigating through all these submenus. I don't know about you. If I use the right-click menus rather than the top menus, then I can say layer, colors. That's why I get tired of it, because the menus always disappear for me. Use the tear-off. Everybody know about tear-offs? Now I've got the menu right there, and I don't have to do all that submenu navigation, and I can go through these wonderful color options. So brightness, contrast, I boost the contrast, and it only happens on the selected area. Except I can't tell whether the edge of the selection is going to look really bad. So I can say view, show selection, and the selection boundary goes away. So now I can see, you know, whether I'm going to have a really glaring gap there. The only problem with show selection is that it'll confuse you later. If you leave the selection boundary off, then eventually you're going to do some operation and it's not going to work because you have a selection and you didn't know about it. Oh, great. I have books to give away later on, so I haven't quite figured out how to decide worthy recipients, so we'll worry about that later. So the only problem with this is the tree. It's really contrasty down at the bottom, not contrasty up at the top, so this is no good. Use show selection is on Control T for toggle selection boundary. That's another key that I use a lot, so I remember it. Okay. But I can get rid of the tree, again, with the subtract from the selection. I'm just going to select the tree here, and now I have the area to the left and the area to the right selected. And I can do my brightness contrast again. Now, how about curves and levels? Have people used those much? A little bit. These are alternatives to brightness and contrast, and they're actually much better. They're much more powerful for most operations. You see the histogram of the brightness in the area that I'm modifying. Yes? They do, curves and levels do about the same thing, but with different user interfaces. It's really a matter of preference, which one you like. I like curves most of the time, but I usually try both because for some images, level seems to work better. The one slider is the bright stuff, one slider is the dark stuff, and the one in the middle is gamma. You may have heard gamma in reference to monitors, but it makes quite a difference in the brightness of the center of your image. You don't really need to understand exactly what the histogram is doing and what the gamma is doing, just kind of drag sliders along, or you can try auto levels, which never does the right thing, but it might, and it's easy to try, so.
Auto, I find, works if you start at a whole image, like if you're kind of, yeah, auto that's coming a little bit dark, a little bit light, auto sometimes just magically fixes it up, but it's very sometimes.
Yes, sometimes it magically fixes it up, and sometimes it's awful. So yeah. Try it, and if you don't like it, hit reset. I don't believe there is an option to turn off on tear off menus in GIMP. It's an option in GTK. And it should be built in, but if it's not, I'm not sure how to turn it on. Okay, let's do curves now. Okay, curves is just a different interface. It's harder to understand what curves is doing, except that generally the dark stuff is here and the light stuff is here. So, and this is kind of in the middle, so I don't know. Actually, I want it darker. Make it darker. You can drag the curve around. You can make a fancy curve. That's actually not too bad. Yeah, that'll do. Get rid of the selection boundary. Yeah, that's probably okay. I think I like curves because I just like dragging things around and doing whizzy things. It almost, you can make amazing curves like that. You can do all kinds of weird stuff. You can also get rid of points by dragging them to the nearest other point. Most of the time, it won't really help to add more than 2 points, but play with it. It's a lot of fun to play with. You get an interactive preview in the image, and you can see what you're doing, and it's neat. Okay, I'm going to get rid of my selection. Select none.
What do you want to do it as well as the transform the edges?
I will be, right, this is another case where you're catching me and saying, oh, Akana, you're doing easy stuff. This is all rectangular selection, and real images are almost never like this. And I actually didn't choose this image for that reason, but it's true that real selections are much harder, and I will be talking about that. Let's see, I don't think I need this anymore. In fact, let's get to it. This is kind of a static image. It's pretty if you like dead tree images, which I do, but it might be better with some life in it. Whoops. Open. Like penguins. Penguins always improve everything, don't you think? So we saw how selection can help you do an operation on only a small part of an image, but the more common use for selection is to cut something out of one image and stick it into another. So I'm going to cut the penguins out and stick it into the Grand Canyon image. There may not be a lot of penguins at the Grand Canyon, but there ought to be, don't you think? Yeah. Okay. So the obvious thing is the lasso tool, right? And anybody who's tried this is laughing at me. You never use the lasso tool. But I'm just going to show how it works. You can kind of drag something out, and you can see I've already kind of gone outside the lines. I was never good at coloring inside the lines when I was in kindergarten either. And it's just really hard. You have to hold your finger down on the mouse the whole time, and you have to have the image small enough that it displays on your screen, and it's impossible. The lasso tool is horrible for selection. So what do you do? Well, one way is the paths tool. That lets you zoom in. I'm hitting equals, my nice key binding I set up earlier. You can scroll around with a mouse button, and you can make these, what's going, whoa. I'm getting double clicks from this mouse for some reason. And you can basically draw a dotted line, connect the dots. And if you want to be really careful, you can make little dots, or you can make big dots. You can even, can't really see that. You can even drag curves out and make curved lines. And that works pretty well. And for years, I thought that was the best way of making selections. And I would make these painstaking selections, and I would have like 1,000 dots around my deer following the lines of the antlers and everything. And it would take hours, and my hands would just be really sore. And there's nothing wrong with the paths tool. I mean, sometimes it really is the best tool, but I'm going to show you a better way, which is not this one. This is intelligent scissors, which is kind of like the paths tool, intelligent scissors. It's a great idea. It's supposed to find boundaries in the image. So you click pretty much close to where you want the selection to be. And it's supposed to follow it, except I don't know if you can see that, but it's following the black line of the penguin's neck. Sometimes you can move it a little, but sometimes it won't pay attention to you. Intelligent scissors is really frustrating. Most people find it so. Every now and then there's an image where it works really well, but most of the time you probably won't be happy with it. So I'm going to go back to the lasso tool that I said not to use. And I'm going to make a really bad selection around the penguins. Trying not to make you wait too long for this. And I'm not worrying too much if I follow the lines or swap inside the lines, because I'm going to correct it later. And that's really the essence of making a good selection, is being able to correct it and tune it. Okay, so now I have kind of a penguin selection. Just to show what I have, I'm going to, edit, copy, edit, paste. Well, those are a little big also. We'll deal with that later. But the key, I think, to making good selections is something called a quick mask. And it's this little tiny button way down in the lower left of the screen, and most people never see it, and I went for years and years never knowing it was there. But if you click it, suddenly you have a mask showing you exactly where your selection is. Now, an area can be selected fully, partially, or not at all. Not at all, you'll see red. You can change the colors by right-clicking on the quick mask button. So if you have an image with a lot of red in it, you can change the quick mask to green or blue or something. But red's fine for this one. And then you can paint on the quick mask, for instance, with the paintbrush tool. I'm going to use a fuzzy brush because I don't want a sharp edge around my selection. Otherwise, that'll show up glaringly when I paste it. So I'm going to pick a big fuzzy brush, and I'm going to zoom way in. And then I'm just going to paint in. Oops. You can undo if you swap. And zooming way in and scrolling around helps a lot. At least if you're kind of a klutz with a mouse like I am. Now, I'm not going to try to make this perfect because even with the quick mask, there's really no shortcut to making selections. You do have to spend some time to make a good one. But let's make it kind of semi-okay. Whoops. Hit the edge of the desk here. And this is just so much easier than either the path tool. You have full control over what's fuzzy and what's not. And you can see your selection right in front of you at all times. Yeah. GIMP is a lot easier than a dark room. Okay, I'm going to zoom out again. And that looks pretty good. I see something over here I want to fix. But you know, that's a pretty quick way of getting a selection. And for that deer antler that I was talking about, it's great for that because you can draw lines. Like, everybody know how to draw lines? You click somewhere, if you're in a drawing tool, hold shift, and you can see the line. Obviously, I don't want that line, but that's great if you're trying to select tree branches, like the gentleman asked about earlier. So when I was eliminating the area of the tree from my selection, I could easily have switched to the quick mask and painted in this branch and this branch. So you notice I'm drawing with black. Black is the foreground color, so everywhere I draw black, the quick mask paints red, and that area will not be selected. If I draw in white, it will be selected. I find it a little confusing to remember which is which, so it's easiest to start with a selection that's approximately right, and then you can tell what's right and what's not. Yes? Oh, it's an image that's really pink? No, it's always pink unless you configure color and opacity. Yeah, and clicking on that brings up a color selector. So you can make it any color you want. Okay, when you're done with the quick mask, click here, and you've got a selection, which I'm going to copy. Paste. Yes. Yes. It pastes to another layer. Well, sort of. When you paste something into an image, it pastes to a floating selection, and that was the next thing I was going to talk about. Floating selections are really, really confusing. That's another area of GIMP that no one understands, and if you go ask the GIMP developers, why are there floating selections? No one remembers. And hopefully that means that someday they will be removed, but they aren't removed yet. So whenever you paste, you want to immediately do one of two things. Click the anchor button, which takes the thing you just pasted, the floating layer, and merges it in with the layer below it, and then you'll only have one layer again. Or, and I don't recommend doing that, actually. What I recommend is always clicking New Layer, which will take the floating selection and turn it into a real layer, no longer floating. So now I have this pasted layer, and layers are the next thing I want to talk about. But I think before we do that, I think it's probably time for a 5-minute break because they wanted to change the batteries on the camera. So let's have a break. If anybody wants to ask any questions, that's fine, and then we'll move into layers. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Everybody ready to go? Okay, let's get started. No. Now, I didn't talk about the layers dialog before. Now, if you're like me, when you the very first time you ran GIMP, you got this weird dialog that came up that said layers, and you had no idea what it was, and you got rid of it. And every now and then, something layer-related happens, and you go, oh, layers! And you undo whatever you were doing and find a simpler way to do it. And I hear that a lot, and it's definitely how I approached GIMP myself. But layers, don't be afraid of layers. And if there's one thing that I want to get through in this talk, I want you all to be really comfortable with using layers, and I want you to go home and make layers that are, or make images that have lots and lots of layers, because that really is the power of GIMP. So if you've hidden the layers dialog, get it back, file, dialogs, layers, we'll bring it back, or Control-L, I guess. I'm going to rename this layer, because when you get lots of layers, it can get confusing. Penguins. Okay, so I've got my background layer, I've got my penguins layer. And one of the reasons that having multiple layers is so useful is that sorry, I should have said that. I double-clicked. Yeah. Double-clicking lets you change the name. There's some other layer properties you can change, but the name is mostly all you'll ever want to change. If you have a separate layer, it means that you can still make modifications. You can move them around. You can stand them on the horizon there. Well, that's kind of a strange image still. I think what we really need to do is make them smaller, so scale the layer or selection. Most GIMP operations, if a layer is selected, will work only on the current layer. So you can save everything you've done before, add another layer, scale only that. You get the usual annoying dialog that pops up. That's probably about right. And then I can move the layer. There. But there's something a little funny about that. The light on the tree is coming from this way, and the light on the penguins is coming from this way. So I'm going to say layer where is it? Transform. Flip horizontally. That's better. That looks much more realistic, don't you think? Another good use for layers is the text tool. Click in the image, you get a dialog that comes up. And that's a bit large. Oh, yeah, you can type here. I hit tab after I type. And that's a bit small. And the text tool has some great options. You can change the color interactively. I can make it yellow. Now it shows up. I can also change the font. And I have lots and lots of fonts here. I love fonts. And if I hadn't already chosen a font, then I would probably be here for the rest of the tutorial just going through all the fonts and trying to pick one.
Is there a way of sorting fonts?
That was exactly what I was going to show you. Yes, GIMP fonts, if you've dealt much with fonts in Linux, you're probably going, oh no, fonts are awful, fonts suck on Linux. But programs like GIMP actually make fonts very easy. Now remember, I'm in my home directory, .gimp2.2. Well, there's a directory called fonts there. If you want fonts that are visible only to GIMP, I don't think I have any, but you can put them in that directory. You can also put them in .fonts, I think. And as you can see, I'm a font junkie. I have three pages of these things. Just TTF files. You can go on the web, search for free fonts. You'll find zillions and zillions of them, and you'll spend the next 3 days just going through font sites and downloading them all. And all you have to do is stick them in your .fonts directory, and GIMP will pick them up. You might have to restart X. I'm not sure, but definitely have to restart GIMP for them to be picked up. And then you get this huge fonts dialog. If you don't like dealing with them in the drop-down, there's also a fonts dialog somewhere there, which always comes up too small. And then you can scroll around and look at all your fonts and change them. That's not a bad one. So, yeah, color, font. It has various other, you can change justification and so forth, which every now and then you'll want to use. This is still too big. And again, since it's a layer, I can move it around at any time. I can also do operations on just the layer. For instance, you can't quite see that I have a script foo menu here. In 2.4, you no longer need to know what language things are written in. All the menus are consolidated. But right now, I want drop shadow, which happens to be in the script foo menu. And I get a drop shadow on the text. I can also link these two layers together. This is the text layer. You can tell it's a text layer because it has this T. And because it has the T, it means I can go back and change text properties by clicking on the layer. You notice the color changed and the font changed to indicate the properties of the layer. If I click on it again, then I can change the text. But meanwhile, if I link these two layers using the chain link, then when I do certain operations like moving them, they'll move together. Oh, notice I did the drop shadow before I added the exclamation point. So the drop shadow does not, the drop shadow is not a text layer, it's just an image layer. So it doesn't follow any changes I make to the text after all, after that. Next. Oh. Well, I've done a fair amount of work on this. Yes. Yeah. If I do a drop shadow on the text layer, then I'll still get a drop shadow on the text layer. If I do a drop shadow on the drop shadow, then I'll get a bigger, fuzzier shadow. Remove it and create a new one, yeah. In fact, I'll do that. Select the layer, delete, make sure the right layer is selected, and script through shadow, drop shadow. You can change color and opacity and all that. Yes? Yes, in fact, I did that with the penguins, remember? I did layer... layer transform, flip horizontally, rotate, you can do all that stuff. Okay. So now I have a drop shadow that includes the exclamation point. Much better. Yeah, there's actually a quick way to do that. Image auto crop should do that. It was because I had the layer select. Although, from the image menu, it shouldn't care. Auto crop is a little flaky. I actually, I have enough problems with auto crop that actually in the plugins chapter of my book, I take the code and I write a better one. Yeah, see, it never does the right thing. You should use mine. I wrote something called Auto Crop All Layers that does the right thing that I don't seem to have installed on this machine right now. Yes? Floating selections are something stuck into GIMP to confuse you and make sure that nobody ever figures out layers because there's always a floating layer in the way. Anytime you have something floating, make it not float by clicking New Layer. It's very confusing and nobody really knows what they're for. There are some things, sometimes, depending on what tool you have selected, you can move a floating layer by just dragging it without selecting the Move tool. But that's not reason enough to confuse everybody. Yeah, convert it to a normal layer. There was a question over here? No. Okay. Yeah, I'm going to crop to get rid of that transparent stuff. That's dark. And now since I've done all this work, I should save again. But I'm not going to save as JPEG because JPEG is going to lose all my work. Not all my work. It'll save the image as you see it on the screen. But that's not what I want because I may want to come back and change the text or do something else. I want all the layers. I want all this stuff selected. So now I'm going to save as XCF. If I could type it. And since I did a save as, it changed the current file name to that. So now I can just type Control S whenever I've made any change, and I'm safe. Yes?
I noticed on the dialog, one of the
I think that's an XPM. If you save as C source code, I think it'll save as XPM. Yes? No, I don't think XCF saves the undo history. And that's probably worth mentioning. The layers dialog has some other cool stuff in it. It has channels which are mostly useful. Channels are mostly confusing, and mostly you don't want to use channels. But there's one thing that channels are good for, and I'm going to change images here. With the penguins, I spent enough time making a selection. I might want to save it. What I can do is in the select menu, save to channel. And if you can see the little tiny icon there, as a channel, I have the selection that I made. If I then later, if I right-click on that, I can do channel to selection. So I can get that selection back even if I make another selection later on. That's a really useful way of saving a selection. Other than that, you don't want to use channels. They're almost never useful. Path. Remember I used the path tool earlier and I started making a path. It saved that path there. So that's another way of kind of saving a selection. If you make a complicated path, you can save that. And your undo history shows up in that tab. So the other tabs are somewhat useful, but most of the time I just use the layers tab. Okay. Do we have time for that? Oh, which one should we do? I don't believe it saves most of the details like selections, and I can't remember if it saves layers to Photoshop format. There's fairly limited support of Photoshop format. Yeah, if you save to Photoshop format, you definitely will lose some things, but it may be enough. So it depends. If you use Photoshop a lot, it's worth it. Otherwise, I wouldn't recommend it. Okay. GIMP Shop is useful for some people. It is useful for situations like that where you have a lot of people who are used to Photoshop and they want an easy transition to GIMP. But generally, I wouldn't recommend using GIMP Shop because it's not really very well supported. Nobody who supports GIMP knows anything about GIMP Shop because we use GIMP. And the GIMP Shop people, there doesn't seem to be an active mailing list or anything like that. So if you have problems, you're kind of on your own. And you can ask Photoshop people, but it's not really Photoshop and it's not really GIMP. So you end up being on your own for that. And that's why I don't recommend it to most people. I think it's very good for a class of people who need it, but generally not. Well, I'm going to, what should I talk about? Kind of, in order not to run over time, I think I'm going to leave this image. Because I want to show you one other cool thing. This is kind of a fun thing, and it's not quite as useful as layers and the quick mask and all the stuff I've been showing you, but it's just so neat that it's good to know it exists. Now, this is a picture of a car my husband used to have, and it's an okay car, and it's an okay color, but we kind of wondered what it might look like in another color. And, of course, GIMP is an interesting way of checking that. Now, anybody here watch cooking shows? The Food Channel or anything like that? Only a few. Well, when you watch cooking shows, often someone will mix up ingredients and put them in the oven and then pull them right out of the oven again. Well, I've done that. I have a mask that I've already made. Oh, I didn't mention you can turn off layer visibility by clicking on the eyeball icon. So I've got the full image, and then I've got this mask, which is the part of the car that I want to, where I want to change the color. I'm not going to try to colorize the wheels or the street or the house or anything like that. Now, with the quick mask. Yeah, I think I did select by color, which is this thing, which doesn't usually work all that well. But sometimes you can get a good start with select by color, and then you can change it with the quick mask. Sometimes. Yeah, the magic wand is kind of similar to select by color. The only difference is, that's true. Well, you can set thresholds for both of them. But I always find that the difference between the darkest areas and the lightest areas are so great that those tools don't seem to work for my photos. There are photos for which they'll work, but GIMP 2.4 also has another tool called PhiOx, the Simple Image Object Extractor, which is really good when you have something like a red flower against a black background or something like that. When you have a really, really glaring contrast, then PhiOx is amazing. It'll just, you kind of move, you wave the mouse around on the area you want selected, and it figures out what colors you're interested in and gets rid of everything else. For something like a car, the car is too close to the street and it wouldn't work, and so it's not perfect. Nothing's perfect. Selection is always going to be some work. There's no magic button, but you can make it easier by knowing what tools are available. Now, there are various ways of changing colors, of course. In the colors menu, there's this map submenu. You can do things like, you know, color range mapping or, you know, just all sorts of things you can do. You can even do layers, color, hue saturation. I'm just changing hue here. I could make it a little lighter, a little darker, more green, less green. I don't like the green. That's a little better. So there are lots of things you can do with that, and sometimes that's all you need. But there's a nifty trick that you can do. I'm going to pick a red. And, oh, everybody know you can drag and drop in lots of places in GIMP, for instance. You can drag from there. Now, one reason that worked, over here in the layers dialog where I have this mask layer, notice this little unlabeled box here that you would never, ever notice because it doesn't say what it is, but if you mouse over it, it says keep transparency. And what that does is for that layer alone, it won't allow you to draw or fill or do anything outside of an area that already has something there. So, for instance, if I pick the paintbrush tool, swap colors, so I'm drawing in white, it only draws where the layer has something already. Yeah. So keep transparency is useful, but it's also a major source of confusion because sometimes it'll get checked by accident. So if you ever have a layer where you have transparent areas and you're trying to fill them and it just won't fill, that's one thing to check. Always look to see if this box is checked. So remember it's there. I know it's unlabeled. It's really hard to see, but it's a useful box. Now, I dropped this flat red into it. Obviously, that doesn't, nobody's going to believe that the card really looks like that. It's got no shading. It's got no anything. But over here in the layers dialog, there's this funny menu that says normal that you've probably never even noticed, at least I never did. It has layer modes. And you can do this cool stuff with layer modes, not with that one. The thing about layer modes is that they do mathematical operations between the current layer and all the layers below. So, for instance, I'm dividing the current layer by any pixels that are below it. And you can get lots of wild effects, some of which are very useful. And it's very hard to predict, even if you know what the equations are and even if you understand colors mathematically, you probably won't be able to predict what any given layer mode will do. So just try them all. When you're using layer modes, try them each, see what's best. There are some guidelines for what layer modes will do what, but generally trying them is good. This is a good color because if I wanted my husband never to drive the car again and to have it all to myself, I could stick with that. That one's kind of pretty. And some of them don't work at all, don't look realistic, but with another color combination, they might. That one's pretty. One of them, that's my favorite. You would pay a lot of money to go to a paint shop and get a pearl paint job like that. And look at those colors. Aren't they great? No. I wish you could. I would love to be able to tear off the layer mode menu because I always use them like this, one after another. Now, one more thing. Yes?
Once you pick the variables, how do you just say, okay, that's the one I want to move on to the next
slide? Just leave it there. If you save as XCF, it'll save all the layers with the layer modes, but if you save as anything else, you'll get what you see. So,
right.
I'd have to pick another color. Layer modes very often change colors because they're doing mathematical operations. So they're doing like, you know, red minus green. Yeah, you just have to experiment. Oh, okay. What I did for the CRX mask is I made a selection of the CRX, and then I did copy and paste as new layer, and it pasted only the selected area. Everything else was transparent. So I've got this neat color. I rather like this, but you can also remember it was just a solid color. That's what the layer really looks like. Go back to difference. And it doesn't have to be a solid color. I can do other stuff with it. Like, for instance, I could use the gradient tool. And get a nice, let's do a gradient like that. Yeah. And, of course, now it's going to do something completely different in different layer modes. So. And. You know, how much would you pay for that in a paint shop? Well, I think I'm actually out of time. So if there are any other questions, I'll take questions. Yes?
Red Eye.
There is a good plugin. There are actually lots of plugins on registry.gimp.org. You can look for plugins. The user interface for the registry isn't great, but there is a search. So search there. 2.4 has a RedEye plugin built in, and it works really well. They went through all the RedEye plugins and picked the best and integrated it in. And registry.gimp.org. The user interface is a little bit improved in 2.4, but it's not that different, really. And the big change coming for 3.0, which is actually being worked on, is a new back end, which will allow things like adjustment layers. So, for example, a text drop shadow can actually follow its text layer. And that'll be really cool. There's a developer working on it right now, and you can see news of it on the GIMP development mailing list. Sure. And I never got around to giving out the books, so I have 3 books to give out, and maybe... I'll tell you what, come up with good questions. And okay, that's not fair.
There's something that I've never quite figured out how to do. People do masks using background or using an image to fill in the text. Some of them are terrible, but how do you actually do that? Is it a simple click thing?
You know, one easy way to do that is I've got the text layer here, and if I... go back to black, fill in the text, copy, then I can paste it into the quick mask. I don't know if the resolution of these two images is similar, but you want...
So let's say if the background of the car becomes the color of the text.
Okay. One thing you could do is select the quick mask and paste. Remember, I just selected the text, so if I paste into the quick mask. Ooh, that's not working right. Shoot, that doesn't work. Right. You can make a layer mask, for example. I was going to show that, but I ran out of time. If you make a layer mask here and paste into the layer mask, And obviously I have this, it's inverted here. But anyway, if you invert the selection, you can do it that way. Yes. Thank you. So, buy my book.